Hi, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, June 24th, 1996. In the fireside room this morning, our speaker is Vítor Vesztele, beginning his series On the Cross. Today's session is number one and is entitled The Way of the Cross, Itinerary of a Symbol. This session is in session.
Throughout the Christian tradition, calling upon some particular moments in which the way in which the cross was perceived has been differently appreciated or has undergone some changes. Tomorrow we are going to deal with the main criticisms of the theology of the cross. And Wednesday, some of the recovery of the theology of the cross in the contemporary scene. It's very interesting that the theology of the cross has been both an extremely controversial issue in a way in which it has not been for the last centuries in contemporary theology, but also one that has received some of the sharpest criticisms in recent times, coming mainly from feminist and third world theologists. So Wednesday then is a discussion. Tuesday a discussion of the criticisms. Wednesday is a discussion of some of the discovery of the theology of the cross as being an ecumenical resource and also a global resource for theological reflection. Being associated normally with the Lutheran tradition, it's surprising to see that most of the works that have been done on this are works that come now from sources other than Lutheran. And some of the books that I have asked to be in the bookstore will give you an idea of this. And I would recommend them to you, and because they are just about the resource that I thought that would be ready available for anyone that would like to continue the discussion on the reading. One of them is this book by, it's published by Abington. It's a very short but nice book. Is a feminist reappropriation of the theology of the cross. It's Sally Purvis, The Power of the Cross. The other one has become already a classic. It's Juan Sobrino, is a Spanish Jesuit who has lived for the last two decades in El Salvador, in Central America. And this is his second Christology, second book on Jesus Christ. It's called Jesus the Liberator, and it's very interesting as a Jesuit, the way in which he draws upon the Lutheran tradition quite explicitly. I would hardly recommend, especially the latter part of the book that deals specifically with the question of of the cross, the third part of the book. But all the book is. And this is a nice and interesting book here that was just published by Orbis, The Scandal of a Crucified World. It's published by an Ethiopian theologian called Jakob Tesfai, and has a collection of essays on the cross from all the parts of the world, actually, and represents both criticisms of the theology of the cross and also some reappropriation of the theology of the cross. So it's one of the most representative books for the discussion, for the contemporary discussion on the issue today. And so it includes writers from Africa, from Latin America, from Asia, from Europe, and from the United States. The fourth book that I recommended to you, it's also a classic on the discussion of the theology of the cross, is Jürgen Moltmann, the German theologian, the Reformed German theologian. His book from 1974, I believe, The Crucified God, which has been quite a significant work on the discussion of the significance of the cross for the world today. So Thursday, I will try to elaborate on some possibilities for reworking a theology of the cross in face of the criticisms that we have, that we would have been exposed to before that. And then finally, Friday, I'll try to discuss the relationship between the cross and the resurrection, which is the crucial point for the whole discussion of the theology of the cross. So the relationship between the cross and the resurrection under the title, The Practice of Resurrection, which I'll explain what I mean by that by when we get there. Okay? I would like to proceed in the following way. I do have some material that I would like to share with you. Are you listening? Are you hearing in the back there? Yeah. If you are not hearing or if my accent gets in the way, please interrupt me anytime. I would like just to go about trying to say some of the things that I have prepared for these sessions, but keeping it open and playing it by ear. So that at the moment in which you have questions, comments, or whatever you wanna say or contribute to the discussion, I would really expect you to intervene and just jump into the midst of the discussion, and we can continue from there on. So I don't intend to do a presentation part that's going to be separated from a discussion part. So just jump in, and we can continue the discussion and move it along the way in which you wanna go. And if it goes into issues that I have planned for the forthcoming sessions, I'll just let you know that more of that is going to come later on. Okay? Is there any question regarding format or anything like that you have? Or just information? Before we begin, I'm trying to kill a bit of time and see if the power comes back on in the tape recording. Now, otherwise, we can just.
I've been taping all of this.
Oh, you have been taping all of that. Okay, good. let's start just with some impressions that you have when you hear the word cross. Or when you see a cross, either a crucifix or just a plain cross, just a sort of a brainstorming or one of those free association exercises that might help us to get to know what comes to your mind when you hear that. Who would you like to start? Just a word. What's the first word that comes to mind? What?
A gift.
A gift.
Pain.
Execution.
Suffering.
Intersection.
Salvation.
Christian.
Identifies usually a Christian versus a
anything
Jewish
else.
Person or a
Muslim.
Mm-hmm. At least superficially. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Anything else?
Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
Despair.
Safety.
Harshness.
Hope.
Yeah.
Misunderstood.
Good. Would it make a difference to you if Jesus would have died of old age in a bed?
Probably would have made a difference to you.
Yeah. To me?
To him.
To him.
I don't think he intended to start a church. I think he, just like Martin Luther, was there to reform the Jews. I think Martin Luther was trying to reform the Catholics. I don't think Martin Luther would like what he got.
Wait, I think you came in.
I'm too late.
Oh, my God. I'm sorry.
Better listen. Okay.
It would make a difference, in a sense. I'm not sure what the symbol or the sign would be if Jesus died of old age.
Yeah.
So we would lose a symbol.
I think so.
Hard work.
That would be all.
No, not all. But I mean, that's the first thing that comes into my mind.
Sure.
That there is something about the sign of the cross that would be not there.
I saw the movie The Last Temptation of Christ. I didn't read the book. I don't know how accurate the movie is to that. But the speculation of Jesus, who had did everything as we understand it, except who got himself off the cross and went on to have a fuller, richer life. And when he meets Paul later on and says, you know, I've lived the same life, I just didn't actually physically die on the cross, Paul says, I'm not interested in you. I needed the drama of that cross moment in order to have a message to present.
Yeah, right. This is the book. Actually, I saw it in the bookstore here. It's Kazantzakis' The Last Temptation of Christ, which is the description of exactly this discussion. What would have happened if Jesus would not have died on the cross, or if Jesus had actually done what people had suggested him to do, step down from the cross and just keep on living? And that's this interesting discussion that we'll just hear Jesus meeting Paul in a square and Paul preaching him crucified, right? Paul's word, and all that we know is Jesus and him crucified. And Jesus calling attention to him, well, I haven't died. He said, it doesn't matter. Really, what matters is that people need to know that you have died. So this is a very traditional, the book has been very controversial, but is a fundamental and extremely orthodox, actually orthodox even in the Eastern sense of orthodoxy, is an orthodox depiction of the significance of the cross as being the central event for the Christian faith, in the way in which Paul would say, all we know is Christ and him crucified. But the reason why I ask you to give all these images related to the cross is because I think the way in which we react to a symbol or to a word is that which makes us think, and that which gives us way of going about our own personal relationship to that symbol, the cross. And I think you have seen that we have not even very diverse ideas that this symbol gave rise to, but we have had quite contradictory ones as well, right? At least very different one, from despair to salvation, from crossing to hope, and so forth. All these images that came around when you were saying it, they mixed together or blended together the two extremes on a continuum. Senselessness, meaninglessness on the one side, and hope, fulfillment on the other side. And I think that's the most important thing if we try to recover or to trace back the history of the symbol of the cross within the Christian tradition. Has been from its inception on, from its very beginning, tense, laden with contradictions, and with conflict. We lose much of that through this itinerary of the symbol of the cross. We lose it, and we domesticate the cross very much through the centuries. And I would like to just point to some examples of how this domestication of the cross tries to come about, because it's tough, it's any scandal, and it's difficult to deal with it. And when we bring the topic of the cross to the middle or to the center of the discussion of the Christian faith, this is really bound to happen, that the scandal is going to come to the surface again, and it's going to be normally difficult for us to try to come to terms again with that central symbol that does not allow for any closure, that cannot be explained away when we really meet it. For example, just for you to have an idea of what it would mean for us if we wouldn't have this history of the domestication of the cross. Try to use an analogy. Would you go out on the streets with a miniature electric chair hanging from your neck? That's the closest analogy for what that cross represented for the people that have been followers of Jesus, the one who was executed in a process that might not have been the same legal process that we have today, but indeed it was a legal process for someone who was being accused, and with some good grounds, and not by a mistake, for some good grounds for being a political subversive. The cross was the political means of executing the lower class citizens or slaves in the Roman Empire, those who represented the political threat to the Roman Empire. The first disciples, when they had to deal with that event, you know very well, they didn't know exactly what to do with that. And in their minds, there were these words of Deuteronomy 21, "Accursed is the one who hangs from a tree." Right? They knew that. How do you deal with that? The first response that we have is the one that's given by Stephen in his speech before he was himself stoned. And you know that being stoned is different than being crucified. Stoned was a religious way of executing someone for apostasy or for blasphemy. Crucifixion was the political way of doing it, right? So before Stephen was executed by stoning, his way of interpreting the cross of Christ was one that we wouldn't think much of it today as being so meaningful to us after a history that has overloaded the cross with meanings that have been important into it. Stephen said simply, you kill the prophets. Who are the prophets you have not, your ancestors have not killed? And now you have killed the just one. So going back to Nehemiah 9, the prophet, the true prophet is killed. The only way of interpreting it is that, well, it's a tragic event. Very sad that happened, but that's what happens with good people, right? But there was no meaning, no salvific meaning attributed to the cross in the beginning. And I think that's important for us to realize, because it lifts up the way in which the cross has been so difficult for the first disciples to come to terms with. The symbol of the cross, that someone here says, well, this is what points to who is a Christian, right? Symbolizes Christianity, distinguishes Christianity from anybody else, from a Jew, from a Muslim, from a Hindu, from a Buddhist, or whatever you have it. Yes, but this is true as a universal symbol for Christians since when? Since 33? Come on here? No. Since 100? No. 200? No. It was on the 4th century only. And here is where the embarrassment starts. It is on the 4th century only when the Christian church is officialized within the Constantinian Empire, the so-called Constantinization of the Church, that the symbol of the cross becomes a universal symbol for the Christians. We have had competing symbols before. You know that the anchor, the lamp, the fish were some of the symbols that the primitive Christians have used. Seldom it was the case that the cross was used as a symbol to distinguish the Christians from other people, or to give an identity to the Christians. Actually, it's on the end of the first century and second century that people find the cross. That archaeologists have found the first signs of the use of the cross by Christians in Roman catacombs. In an old baptismal fountain from the fourth century in the shape of the cross was also discovered, remembering or referring back to the passage of Romans that we heard yesterday, the epistle reading of yesterday, right? We have been baptized into Christ's death. But outside of those ephemeral or eventual uses of the cross, the symbol is in itself not very dominant until much later on. And when it becomes dominant, and remember that when it becomes dominant, it is a blend. It's actually a blend of two things that we now hold very much apart. The cross is a sign of the cosmic dimensions, more or less on the line of this crossing, in which the four dimensions that are, for example, mentioned in Ephesians 3, right? The height, the depth, the breadth, and the length, right? Of the love of Christ is symbolized in this cross. This meaning of the cross as representing the dimensions of all the reality that's encompassed by God's love is very much present, mainly in the association on the relationship between the cross and baptism. And we are going to see a bit more about that, since the theme of this summer in Holden is water washed, spirit born. We are going to point to the relationship between the cross and baptism and later on. But this meaning of the cross was superimposed or overlapped with the other meaning, the one that we are more familiar with now, the historical redemptive act of the crucifixion of a man in Golgotha. That event, that shameful event that put Jesus to death. This has been the dominant meaning that the cross has had in Western Christianity. If you go to the Eastern tradition, the cross normally represents more than the historical event of the crucifixion of Jesus. It represents or symbolizes those four dimensions that we find in Ephesians 3:18. The height, the depth, the breadth, and the length of the love of Christ. They are still blended together. We have separated that quite a lot. The crucifix as such, Jesus hanging on the cross, appears in the Christian tradition only by the 9th century. Quite late, right? And then becomes dominant in the Western piety, the crucifix. Dominant in Western piety. Dominant to such an extent that when the Reformation comes about and brings a change or a transformation in Christian spirituality or Christian piety, it is around the cross that much of the symbolism of the new piety is going to be expressed. Most of the Reformation churches abolished the crucifix, if not the cross. For example, the Reformed churches abolished the cross until the beginning of this as a symbol in their sanctuaries until the beginning of this century. So did the Anglicans even, although they kept the sign of the cross, the crossing. And the Lutherans were the only exception. They kept the cross and they kept the sign of the cross, the crossing, and even the crucifix. But the way in which this happened was not because the cross was regarded as not being so central for Christian, for the Christian faith, but quite to the contrary. The Reformation brought about a transformation in the perception of the cross, exactly in order to lift up its importance. And it's not by chance that Luther is going to say that the cross alone is our theology. And theology of the cross, you know, within the Lutheran tradition, is exactly the same as to say Luther's theological breakthrough. The two things are one and the same. When we talk about the theology of the cross in the Lutheran tradition, we are speaking about the Lutheran breakthrough within the conventional medieval theology at his time. This is the reason why Luther, in a world in which piety was overloaded with cross motifs, says in one of the most well-known texts that he has, and not so frequently read, the 95 Theses, right? He says on the Thesis 92, I think it's 92, yeah, 92, "Away with those prophets who say to the people of God, peace, peace, when there is no peace." This quote in Jeremiah, as you might know, right? Then in the Thesis 93, he says, "Blessed be the prophets who preach to the people of God, cross, 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 when there is no cross." It's a very surprising text if we know a bit about popular piety at that time. The cross was central, fundamental to the piety. Why would Luther say that this cross was not there? Why would he say that blessed are those who say cross, 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 when there is no cross? And the response to that is exactly that the cross for him, as he himself has said it, was adorned with roses. The cross was adorned with roses so as to lose its scandalous aspect, its shocking aspect. So when we talk about the theology of the cross, we are bound to meet again this scandal that's going to, I think, make us, or should at least, make us all very uneasy about what it's, what impact does it have in our life. Do we want to follow the one who has been crucified? Do we want to take up our cross? Is that our way? Is that what we are going to preach? Is that what we are going to preach to people that carry their cross every day of their lives? Or is the theology of the cross, therefore, something only reserved for people who are the thieves and not those who have fallen among the thieves? Douglas John Hall, the Canadian theologian, has made his arguments in his writings about the theology of the cross. He says, well, I am just doing theology for the thieves, not for those who have fallen upon the thieves, among the thieves. That means he's doing theology for, not for the people who suffer the cross, but for those who impose the cross. So he has a selective use of the theology of the cross, because he says, well, I preach the cross only for those who impose the cross, but I cannot do the same for those who live on a daily basis under the cross. Let me suggest to you that this problem, what we do with this cross in a world in which people are crucified on a daily basis, is with the Christians from the very beginning on. For example, a couple of decades after the crucifixion happened, and we are going to see later on what happens in the crucifixion event, as far as we know from the biblical records. A couple of decades after the crucifixion happened, Paul tries to explain why he wanted to preach Christ and him crucified to the community in Corinth. And what he does is to try to come to terms with that event and bring it to the center point of what his theology is all about. How successful is he in doing that? You remember 1 Corinthians, the first chapter, in which he talks about the cross, the power of the cross, being what?
Foolishness.
Weakness, the wisdom, foolishness, exactly. So bring together these extremes, these contradictory terms, foolishness is what manifests wisdom. Weakness is what manifests strength. Very far away from any systematic attempt of explaining what the cross is all about. You have to accept it, as Tertullian would say a couple of centuries later, you have to accept it because it's absurd. And that's what Paul is doing there. That's what Paul is doing. He doesn't have a language. He is a theologian in search for a language to explain that which was so painful, but he had a gut instinct that that's what it was all about, or should be all about. But the language failed him, and as I think it should fail anyone who would try to domesticate the cross. And we are going to see some of this history of this domestication very soon. So what Paul is able to do is to bring contradictory terms and collapse them almost, so to say, together in order to say what could not be expressed in, let's say, a more narrative way, a more systematic, well-constructed mode of thinking. If we go to the Gospel of Mark, for example, the first one of that comes after Paul, right? After Paul writes to the Corinthians, the Gospel of Mark, that's the first gospel to be written, three decades after the crucifixion. What we find there is still, three decades after, remember that, what we find there is still that sense of the scandal very much at the heart of the text. Do you remember the words of Jesus on the cross according to Mark? You could just open the Bible if you have it. It's Mark 15 something. At 3 o'clock, verse 34, right? 3 o'clock, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, "Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani," which means, my God, why have you forsaken me?" Well, he is quoting here, as you know, Psalm 22, the words of Psalm 22, that give Mark the wordings to express what Jesus was feeling on that event. Yes, it would make a difference for him if he would not have died on that cross. That's true. And I think that's what is expressed so strongly in the Gospel of Mark. And it's even more than that. What comes after that? People misunderstand Jesus' words, thinking that he is saying that he is calling for whom?
Elijah.
Elijah. Just think, why would Mark make mention of this, of this event, of this misunderstanding of Jesus' words? It's like if Mark would be saying to his readers, listen, folks, he was not calling for Elijah. It was even worse than that. He was complaining against the one who he had called Abba, Daddy, my father, in his ministry, in his life. Like Mark was saying, listen, folks, we really knew what that was all about. Nothing less than Jesus calling upon God and asking why he had been there on that cross, forsaken by the one who he loved, by the one in whose name he did all his ministry. That's the way in which Mark comes to term with that. Really doesn't solve the mystery. The scandal is very fresh, 3 decades after the crucifixion. The scandal is very fresh. And there is not a response to that. There is no way of smoothing out the words and saying, well, really, was not a word of complaint, like some of the Christian theologians in the centuries that followed. Jesus wasn't really complaining. It was, like one of these theologians said, was a dialogue between the two natures of Christ, the divine and the human, and they were trying to come to terms how to get this two aspects of the Christ's divinity and Christ's humanity together. But in Mark, it wasn't so. In Mark, it was really those words. The scandal was very fresh. But was so important that for Mark, it had to be there and had to be narrated. Had to be part of that story. Different from the other source that we no longer have available, which is simply called the source. We know about it because the synoptic, the three first gospels, they refer to this. To this source was presumably a written sort of a gospel that had most of the parables of Jesus as we know it here. They don't have. It didn't have any account of the crucifixion, of Jesus' death. They wanted to remember the one who really was alive there. The one who taught the great lessons, indeed the great miracles. But the cross, this seems to be too much. There is a Spanish poet, I'll have it for tomorrow, I think. The whole poem is a Spanish poem of the beginning of this century, of the 20th, in this century, who writes about a popular song in Spain called the Saeta, a popular song that goes more or less like this. Who will lend me a ladder to climb up the cross, to take off, to pull off the nails of Jesus the Nazarene? And Antonio Machado, this poet, he goes about commenting on this popular song that people sing on the streets on the time of Lent. And he ends up his commentary, his poetic commentary on this song, saying, "Oh, this is not my song. I don't want to sing to the Jesus of agony, but only to the one that walked over water." And I think that signals some of the criticism that we are going to see related to the theology of the cross, but more to the beginning, to the first experiences, or to the first attempts to come to terms with the cross. Please, as I told you, interrupt me at any moment, okay? When we go a couple of decades after that, the Gospel of Luke, what are the words that Jesus said on the cross there?
Two thieves.
What?
The story of the thieves.
Yeah, that's also Luke's. But the last words of Jesus. Last words of Jesus.
I don't know what the last
words. Yeah, but these were not the last words. Yeah. It's
Father, it is finished.
31. Well,
it's a different idea.
Well, look. Which were the words that Jesus said there? You remember Mark. Matthew follows Mark here, right? Matthew just writes after Mark, and he has Mark as a source. So he follows.
Hey, Father, into thy hands I commit my spirit.
Great, exactly. Into thy hands I commit my spirit. See, interesting, right? It's again a psalm that's being quoted. It's not Psalm 22, but Psalm 31 that's quoted. It's different than to say, Father, in thy hands I commend my spirit, than to say, my God, why have you forsaken me? It's different, isn't it?